On behalf of the Intellectual Property Practice Group, it's my pleasure to introduce you to welcome you to today's panel. My name is Brian Pandya. I'm a partner at Duane Morris and a member of the IP Executive Committee. And it's my privilege and honor to introduce my friend and colleague on the Executive Committee, Judge Ryan Holt, who will be today's moderator. Judge Holt was confirmed to the United States Court of Federal Claims in 2019, and in his 3 years on the bench has become one of the country's top patent trial judges, which is no surprise to anyone who knows Judge Holt, because before that, he was a distinguished professor, or a chaired professor at University of Akron Law School, and before that at Southern Illinois, where he built a reputation as one of the top empirical scholars of the Federal Circuit's jurisprudence. Now, I could go on, and you can read his full bio, and I could talk about his impressive credentials or his publications, his clerkships, his government service, private practice experience, the fact that he's an Eagle Scout. But I'll just mention one thing that I think is relevant to today's topic, and that is that he was, for 6 years, the general counsel and a partner in an electrical engineering technology firm, a startup. And he's the inventor on 5 issued patents, and I hear there's a few more continuations in the pipeline. So I'm really interested to hear Judge Holt's perspective on the topic of innovation as someone who is a named inventor. So with that, I will turn it over to Judge Holt and look forward to today's discussion.
Great, thank you, Brian. We have an exciting panel planned this afternoon. The format is I will do full introductions before each speaker gives 8 to 10 minute opening remarks. And then we will have an opportunity after the opening remarks for speakers to comment on each other's opening remarks and then open things up for questions from the audience. The panel that we have has been titled Competition and Innovation Policy for Tomorrow. And I'll read a brief introduction in order to get things started before introducing our first speaker, Macon Delrahim. As global crises abound from pandemics to war, society cries out for myriad new technologies from healthcare and high tech to manufacturing, energy, environment, and food. This panel will explore how the antitrust and patent systems can best foster competition and innovation in each of these vital areas. With that, our first speaker is Macon Delrahim, currently a partner at Latham & Watkins in D.C. Our second speaker is Professor Christine Farley, currently a law professor at American University here in Washington, D.C. Our third speaker is Andre Yonku, currently a partner at Irell & Manella in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. And then finally, our last speaker is Professor Scott Keefe, currently a professor at GW Law School. For an introduction on Macon Delrahim, and this is a very abbreviated introduction, going in quick chronological order, way back to 1998 to 2003, he served as antitrust counsel and later staff director and chief counsel of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, then deputy assistant attorney general of the antitrust division at DOJ from 2003 to 2005, a commissioner on the Antitrust Modernization Commission from 2004 to 2007, a partner at Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck from 2005 to 2017, then deputy counsel to the president in 2017, and assistant attorney general of the antitrust division of DOJ from 2017 to 2021, before beginning as a partner in Latham's offices in DC and Los Angeles. A couple notes on interesting pieces that he's written in the last year. Issued both in the Wall Street Journal. First, regulation will be good for crypto. Competition lawyers and economists should be part of the federal government's policy deliberations. And antitrust attacks on private equity hurt consumers. Regulators ignore research showing their investments promote competition and increase productivity. Macon.
Well, thank you so much. Judge. And it's great to be back here in friendly atmosphere. I feel old when you read that. Perhaps I am. And it's been a privilege to have had the chance to be involved in the policy apparatus of some of the issues that I absolutely love and believe in. I was 10 years old when I moved to this country and, left that great regime of Iran when the new government came in, and people like me were not welcomed, and you kind of leave with nothing. Innovation and patent system and the intellectual property system is something that's very personal to me. And by the way, Andre and I did not know each other until the last administration, even though we both lived in Los Angeles, both went to UCLA, both were the same age, both moved here to this country when we were 10 years old from different countries. And we had the same exact ideological views, and people thought it was coordinated, pure accident by the White House personnel office for us to have had the roles. And it was a privilege to work with them on the issues where, again, we both cared about. And what this, I think, just purely capitalism is the reward for the risk you take in not only investment, but in the research and development that is required and then rewarded with the patent system, but other intellectual property regimes as well, but specifically patent system. I became a patent lawyer, and no offense to Andre, I got excited more when in practice in antitrust world. So early in my career, I moved away from the patent world, but I've always enjoyed very much the policies around it. Antitrust is in a different state right now in the last 2 years. There's a view that, ultimately we have to look at the snapshot of today, and competition policy is enforced in, is there anything that might move the price? We're not looking deep into what I think Judge Bork and others really brought forth about 40 years ago, what the true purpose of antitrust should be is really efficiencies. And look at the harm to competition rather than to competitors. We don't want to keep weak competitors. We want to advance innovation when you actually have real competition in place. You want innovation. And by innovation, it isn't a snapshot. It isn't, should we enforce the antitrust laws in enforcing the transactions over intellectual property to lower price at that point? It is, what are we doing in the dynamic competition? Are we creating an environment or allowing a regime where the next revolutionary innovation is invested in and brought forth to the marketplace? It's not exciting to have a 5% decrease in price in what this phone is, or what many of you may not remember, the StarTAC phone, one of the first cell phones. It was, what is the next generation that could do that? Now that I could be in my hotel room and watch TV on my phone and watch the election returns, where you couldn't do that in the previous one, is it what is more important to the American consumer? Is it the fact that the StarTAC phone might be 5 cents cheaper today? Or is it the fact that we're gonna have incredible capabilities in the next revolutionary technology? And that's what the patent system rewards. Unless you're just a user of the patents as opposed to the innovator. And the antitrust laws are what, for lack of a better word, regulate how you can monetize that. So my view was antitrust should be enforced in a mechanism, in a way that maximizes that dynamic competition. We, together with Andre and others, were able in the last 4 years to advance policies to allow for that, especially where the courts were going a certain direction because a number of companies were advancing policies, and the previous antitrust division in the previous administration was advancing policies that was much more restrictive on intellectual property, with the argument that, hey, we're going to be lowering the prices. Patents are monopolistic. What I think what we were able to do was really change the policy and the discussion in the courts in the United States as well as in Europe. We've had some of those better understanding of the intersection of antitrust law and intellectual property in the Ninth Circuit, in the Fifth Circuit, in the UK Supreme Court, and the German Supreme Court, the higher case, about that intersection of IP and antitrust to better understand the limits of antitrust law rather than using it in a mechanism that you're inhibiting the maximum incentive to invest in that intellectual property. It's an ongoing fight. Every single day you're having that discussion because people with who are the licensees of technology always want to pay less. And they'll come up with creative arguments. They'll come up with arguments that we've never seen before because some academic will come up with a paper, well-funded paper, that will say that this should be an antitrust violation or this other thing should be an antitrust violation. They'll advance it through the courts, and all you need is one judge to agree or an ITC commissioner to agree, and then now you have some changes in the laws. And I think it's really important to be vigilant. Otherwise, the underlying incentive for what made this country, I think, the spirit of entrepreneurism, the technology base that we have that has been a pride, you know, for the U.S., whether it's in pharma, it's in information technology or other areas, we'll lose that. We'll lose that to other countries that begin to be a lot more inviting of that type of risk reward. And it's been a shame to see that over the years. It's been a bipartisan policy to advance strong intellectual property laws here in China and Europe and other countries. And the last, I'd say, 7-8 years, there has been an attack on the intellectual property system in the United States, both in Congress and in the courts. And looking forward to this discussion.
Great. Thank you, Macon. Next up on our panel is Professor Christine Haight Farley at American University here in Washington, D.C. She is currently a professor of law and faculty director for the Program on Information Justice and Intellectual Property and on the board of directors for the Center for Inter-American Legal Education. Previous to this, she has served as an instructor for 9 executive-level courses on U.S. intellectual property law for Cuban lawyers in Havana since 2012, as a member of the Presidential Task Force on Brands and Innovation of the International Trademark Association from 2013 to 2015, was a speaker in the Department of State program in India, Intellectual Property and Innovation, back in the summer of 2018, and served as a reporter for the U.S. and Canada for the WIPO, writing the status report on protection against unfair competition of WIPO member states for 2022. Her recent scholarship includes Do Trademarks Reduce Search Costs in the Age of Information, coming out in the Research Handbook on the Law and Economics of Trademarks in 2023, I believe that's coming out, and a recent Law Review article, The Lost Unfair Competition Law in the Trademark Reporter and in the Akron Law Review, which was part of a wonderful conference I helped organize, Confusing the Similarity of Trademark Law and Domain Name Disputes. Professor Farley.
Great. Thank you. I feel very honored to be on this extremely distinguished panel. I have been drawn to intellectual property in the course of my career because of the interesting challenges it deals with in terms of wanting to protect information and also wanting to free information, and because of its purpose, which is to encourage and facilitate innovation. Now, when we think of innovation, we tend readily to think about patents and inventors. And I'm going to leave that topic to the next speakers who can handle that topic far better than I can. But I wanted to round out the discussion in thinking about all of the other innovative activities and innovation policies that we have in US law. Because innovators, as well as creators and entrepreneurs, need to have protection over a whole host of things that support them, such as trademarks, trade dress, geographical indications, copyrights, moral rights, trade secrets, design patents, utility patents, of course, plant patents, unfair competition, false advertising law, domain name law, and probably there's more that I'm not mentioning right now. But it is a very comprehensive and broad landscape. And these other rights not only substitute in cases where innovators cannot reach that very high threshold for protection that patent law offers, but also complements the various protections that might seem like the first order protection given the activity. Of course, innovation policy needs to incite entities that have capital and have talent, because those companies are in the best position to bring the tangible benefits of innovation into the everyday lives of Americans. But it must also address the needs of individual inventors, creators, startups, and small businesses. This group of individuals and small actors is important because so much innovation, creativity, and business ideas start here. Innovation policy that works best for these actors is one that recognizes bottom-up innovation. IP laws are one size fits all, and we hope they do fit all, but we have to ensure that they do, or we miss the latent potential that surrounds us. IP needs to be accessible to individuals and small businesses, and it needs also not to be a barrier to them. So I've been speaking at a general level, but I want to turn now to specifics and return to the topic of trademark law. We have seen over the past 5 years an increase in interest in trademarks from entrepreneurs. And this tracks quite a dramatic shift to direct-to-consumer businesses. So rather than having to develop distribution channels or build a brick-and-mortar store, now small businesses can have an online presence and have access to a very wide audience quite quickly. At the same time, those advantages come with a very urgent need for IP protection. And companies find that they need to find some way to keep their competitors at bay. The first moat that they can build around their business is a trademark. And at the same time that we've seen this interest in trademarks, we've also seen another development in trademarks. And that is a recent surge in applications to the trademark office. So in 2021, we had 63% more applications than we had in 2020. And in 2020, we had 57% more applications than we had in 2019. So these are the highest numbers that the agency has ever seen. And what's fueling that surge in applications? Not entirely, but quite an important cause is China. 29% of all trademark applications filed in the USPTO last year came from China. And that's up from 1% just 10 years ago. Why are we seeing the surge from China? Two reasons: the Chinese government and Amazon, or maybe Amazon and others, but mostly Amazon. The Chinese government pays its citizens the equivalent of $1,500 to file to receive foreign trademark registrations. And Amazon bumps up sellers who can demonstrate that they have a U.S. trademark registration in their listings and provides other benefits to those sellers. Is this a good development? On the one hand, it does bring more revenue into the USPTO, but on the whole, no, it's not. Because it clutters the registry, and that makes it much harder to receive a trademark, and it makes it take longer to receive a trademark. So just as an example of that, it used to take 2 to 3 months for a trademark application to come before the trademark examiner, and now it takes 12 months just to get in the hands of a trademark examiner, and that's only the beginning of the system. This hurts small businesses who can't plan for these delays and can't develop alternative strategies. And meanwhile, Chinese applications register faster, at faster rates. This may be because many, if not most, of these applications are junk. They are designed to avoid office actions from the USPTO. So one example is there's a number of trademarks coming from China that are for unpronounceable, meaningless, unmemorable strings of letters, because those will obviously register faster. And many of these applications are worse than junk. They're fraudulent. Many of these Chinese filers file for use-based applications because use-based applications are processed faster. And they submit fake specimens of use to the agency. By copy and pasting photos that they find online and photoshopping the trademark onto them. There was an interesting case from the Eastern District of New York in 2020 where a small U.S. company that sold home furnishings online under the mark Sagonizer had relied on common law trademarks and hadn't registered their trademark, as many small companies do. A Chinese entity applied for registration of the same mark, and they made a use-based application for a very broad list of goods in the same class as the American company. And they, as a specimen of use, took a picture from the American company's Amazon listing and submitted that as their specimen of use. The registration was issued to the Chinese entity, who promptly filed it with Amazon. And as a result, Amazon delisted the US company, citing trademark infringement. So this small US company that didn't have the legal budget to apply for a trademark then had to litigate in federal court just to be able to get back online. Because the surge of these applications is crippling our system, the USPTO has developed a number of new policies to deal with it. But not all of these policies are well suited for small businesses. For instance, next month, a new rule will take effect in order to reduce the processing time. Whereas an applicant used to have 6 months to respond to an office action from the USPTO, it will now have only 3 months. Again, Chinese applications don't ordinarily get office actions, so they won't be affected by this rule. And this rule will be most burdensome to small companies who most likely hadn't already retained a trademark lawyer and need to figure out this system, and now they have to do so in half the time. I expect that there will be a number of missed deadlines and therefore abandoned applications. So in conclusion, we don't have a top-down approach to innovation policy, nor should we. China does. It pays for people to get IP. It decides which industries and which technologies are priority and sets quotas. And it seems to work for them, at least in the short run, although the long-term prospects are very questionable. The top-down approach is certainly their competitive advantage, but it's not ours. Our competitive advantage is our tradition of organic, bottom-up innovation and creative activity. And we need to make sure that we hear the needs of the smallest innovators, creators, and entrepreneurs and responsibly fine-tune our system so as not to disadvantage them. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Farley. That's our first applause. And now people know that our order of speakers was intentional, so we can let Andre, after his introduction, explain how he's not responsible for the junk Chinese patents and the extreme delay in trademark prosecution. So next up is Andre Iancu, currently a partner at Irell and Manella, focusing on intellectual property litigation and patent office trial and litigation in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. Prior to his return to the law firm, he served as the Undersecretary of Commerce for Intellectual Property and Director of the Patent Office from 2018 to 2021, and before that was back at Irell and served as the Managing Partner of the law firm from 2012 to 2018. He's also currently the Chairman of the Board for the Council for Innovation Promotion, referred to as C4IP, which is a new bipartisan coalition dedicated to promoting strong and effective intellectual property rights that drive innovation, boost economic competitiveness, and improve lives. He also serves as a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Two of his recent op-eds within the last couple months include, quote, "Scapegoating Patents Won't Lower Drug Prices," published on Bloomberg Law, and "America's 21st Century Sputnik Moment" on Real Clear Policy. Director Iancu.
Thank you, Judge Holt. Great to be with everybody here. And I remember fondly a couple of years ago, right before the pandemic, Macon and I being on almost the same panel up here talking about similar issues while we were both serving. What an honor that that was. let me, by the way, you can hypothesize about all the reasons why it's now taking a whole year to process trademark applications. All I will say is that in the Trump administration, it took only 3 months to process those applications. But you're right, there is a surge of applications from China, both on patents and trademarks. It's been going on for quite a few years now. The reasons that Professor Farley mentioned are correct. They are giving incentives, which is inappropriate. We published a report at the USPTO exactly on this issue. But it's really important for the United States not to underestimate the other reason why the Chinese are filing a lot of patent and trademark applications around the world. It's because they are innovating. They have become an innovative society, and we cannot turn a blind eye to this. By every measure, they are outperforming us in almost all the technologies that matter. And the United States needs to double down and increase our innovation if we are not to lose our technological edge for the technologies of the next industrial revolution. Already, in some of the technologies that make a huge difference to our lives, we have lost that edge. Take, for example, 5G, 6G installations around the world. More than 50% of those installations around the world in the last year, 2 years, have been by two companies, Huawei and ZTE, more than 50%. And this is despite United States and Western sanctions. American companies installing 5G and 6G around the world, less than 10%. On artificial intelligence, we are about to lose our edge. China is filing six times as many patent applications on deep machine learning than the United States. On quantum computing, we are competitive, but the Chinese have already demonstrated a quantum satellite uplink, while we are still working on developing and proving out terrestrial transmissions. In category after category, the Chinese are putting out more patents, more trademarks around the world than we are. It's not even close. Now, patents and trademark applications have their own problems because of the manipulations in the numbers that the professor has just mentioned. But nevertheless, it's a trend to keep an eye on. Scientific publications in peer-reviewed journals, they publish more than American scientists do. Numbers of graduates with engineering and other STEM degrees far, far outpace what we put out in the United States. The only way we're going to compete for the technologies of the future is if we double down and innovate at a much, much faster rate than we are doing right now. And the only way a free market society like ours can do that, a society that is not centralized or dictated to from top down, as Professor Farley mentioned. The only way to do that is with a robust intellectual property system. It's the only incentive and protection that we have under the rule of law to encourage investors to dedicate their time and money to these inherently risky activities. It is the only consistent policy that can drive innovation. And this is a major disconnect Despite the fact that this is true, and those of us who are in the field know this, there is a huge disconnect among our leadership, both on Capitol Hill and in the administration, and this is a bipartisan issue, in understanding this fundamental link between a strong intellectual property system and a strong innovation economy. If you go up on Capitol Hill and you ask members now, almost anyone you walk into the hallway, hey, do you think we should have more invention or less invention in the United States? I think you'll get near unanimous, it should be unanimous, but who knows with these people. You're gonna get almost unanimous responses. Of course we should have more innovation in the United States. But then you ask the next question. Should we have a strong intellectual property system? Should we have more patents in order to support that innovation? Oh, well, now we don't know. We don't know. Patents, you know, they can act as a barrier to access to innovation. It can, you know, there's patent trolls and there's patent thicketing and evergreening and all sorts of problems with patents. So I don't know. I want innovation, but I don't know. Maybe we achieve that with fewer patents or no patents at all. And I'm not making this up. This is happening on the front pages of newspapers right now. The President of the United States, in one breath, in one sentence, praises the amazing innovation of our biotechnology industry for creating these life-saving vaccines. And in the same sentence, he ends it with, and now we should waive intellectual property protections for those vaccines so that more people can have access to it. Without giving it even a thought to the fact that you wouldn't even have had these vaccines in the first place or anything close to it, but for our patent system. There is this major rift between wanting an innovation policy and understanding that the only way you can get that is with a robust intellectual property policy. So how do we go about doing that? How do we ensure a robust intellectual property system? Because the winds right now are very strong against it. And how do we see it, as I said, on the front pages. And the question you have to ask yourselves is, who in industry is pushing for weakening the intellectual property system? It is not a coincidence that the biggest voices against a strong intellectual property system are the well-established, very large, monopolistic with monopolistic tendency companies that mostly operate on the internet out of the West Coast of the United States without naming any names. Why is that? Because patents and other forms of intellectual property are actually pro-competitive tools. They enable the little guy, they enable the disruptor to be able to penetrate and disrupt the status quo and threaten the monopolistic hold that some of these established companies have attempted to impose on our economy. So if we want more disruptive innovation on a going forward basis, if we don't want to lock in the status quo, if we don't want the largest companies to get larger, then you have to support a strong intellectual property system, which is the only way to catalyze a strong disruptive innovation system. So when folks ask, are patents monopolistic or anti-competitive, I say it's quite the opposite. Patents and trademarks and all other forms of intellectual property, copyrights, are pro-competitive. They enable the startup to penetrate and to make change and bring new things to market. So I'll stop there, Ryan.
All right, thank you, Andre. And yeah, very real issues. As I was walking here from the courthouse down K Street, I saw a number of the posters that you all will see, patents kill, at every bus stop. So who would have thought that every person riding a bus in Washington, D.C. is concerned about patent rights here in 2022? Last up on our panel, before we get to comments to other speakers and questions, is Professor and Honorable F. Scott Keefe of the George Washington University Law School, who currently serves as the Fred Stevenson Research Professor of Law at the law school and is also the founder at Keefe Strategies, LLC. In previous years, he worked as a law firm associate, counsel, and partner at various firms in New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C., served as a senior fellow for many years at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, where he built the Hoover Project on commercializing innovation, also served as a member of the Senior Executive Service for many years in our defense and intelligence communities, working part-time and not in a legal role, and finally served as commissioner on the International Trade Commission from 2013 to 2017. Most recently, he has a couple unique opinion pieces, but he is featured in an upcoming documentary, Innovation Race, which relates to, and I quote, "Today, China is threatening American innovation and national security by exploiting weaknesses in U.S. patent protection, and big tech is letting them get away with it." If you're interested in a fascinating documentary, look for Innovation Race. And then finally, a couple opinion pieces. UK rulings give Chinese courts wide powers in IP disputes. Next, Chinese courts are deciding key patent cases. The U.S. and its allies should be wary. And finally, it's time for America's trade umpire to cry foul against Russia's aggression. We give Professor Keefe the best title for articles award of the panel as well. Professor Keefe.
Thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be on this panel with friends and colleagues each, and it's a particular pleasure to be on this panel with you, Judge Hault. After all, we met at one of these Federalist Society events at your law school when you were a law student, and it has been a pleasure to watch your career thrive as you've made your way out into the world. And so for the students in the audience, I just want to strongly remind you, look at your future. It's very bright. So thank you, Judge Hault, for being such an example for the students. I think for me, as I listen to my colleagues talk about whether it's antitrust or the suite of competitive regulatory rules or the heart, the guts of the patent system, for me, what I want to try to do in tying together those ideas is to talk to you about you. You, this is a gathering of lawyers. You are lawyer professionals. And yes, there are other professionals in the audience. There are people with a self-described profession of journalism or lobbying or managing. Those are all noble professions as well. This is not a knock against any of the other professions, but it is a recognition that the profession of practicing law is different. It is not merely offering your passionate commitment to your ideas about policy. In fact, that would be serving your own interests. As a lawyer, you serve your client's interest. And as a lawyer, not only do you serve your client's interest, you do it with different tools than the tools of just whatever your argument is, stronger is better and more now. You use legal rules. You, as law students, as lawyers, we are used to breaking out legal rules into prongs or elements or steps. We recognize as people, as humans, that words can be quite malleable. It's not that legal words are somehow less malleable. It's that in the legal profession, in the practice of law, we, like Lego blocks, assemble those words into a two-part test or a three-part test. And we do that not because we like to play with Legos, although that is a lot of fun. We do that because it restrains our thinking. It restrains the power of the government officials to whom we're arguing so that they must somewhat more rigidly than otherwise look at the facts of the record and apply the facts of the record to that two or three or four prong legal test. What we say to our law students is the black letter law outline in law school. And why is that important? It's important because in this space, words like competition or innovation, those words standing alone, they're open textured words. In a policy debate, it's very easy to say, my argument is the innovative one, yours is the non-innovative one. Mine is the good one, yours is the bad one. Mine's the pro-competitive one, yours is the anti-competitive one. Mine's the one that's good for national security, yours is the one that's bad for national security. So in our legal tradition, in our profession, we pick and choose. So for example, one of the most famous big patent antitrust interface cases is a case in the early 1980s in the Supreme Court called Dawson. And if you go and read that long opinion, if you are the kind of lawyer who cares a whole lot about what Congress intended when it wrote a statute, in this particular case, the statute that governs the patent antitrust interface, then the Dawson opinion exhaustively reviews the legislative history to explain why Congress acted and wrote that statute. But, you know, look, some people like legislative history, some people instead like the words of the statute. Turns out, if you look at that statute for the patent lawyers in the audience and the antitrust lawyers in the audience, that's section 271D of Title 35, the patent statute, and its neighboring provisions, 271 A, B, and C. What does section 271 say? Well, what it does is it explicitly defines a set of activities that count as infringement, and then it explicitly says, and if a patentee sues or chooses not to sue and instead to license the good folk who it could have sued for patent infringement, that decision to sue or not sue, that is defined by 271D not to be misuse, not to be anti-competitive in and of itself. Now, that statutory provision doesn't say patentees always win antitrust defense arguments. It says asserting these patents are not per se antitrust violations. It is a middle of the road, somewhat legally technical provision. But we're technicians of the law. That's our profession. That's your profession. And that profession matters. It counts for something. So when you read one of the dissents in the Dawson opinion by the great Justice White, the gravamen of his dissent is, I just really don't understand. The only justification for the majority, other than a whole lot of legislative history, is the plain meaning of the statute. And why should that matter? Well, look, if you think the plain meaning of the statute should not matter at all, then you're with Justice White on that one. But I think that's not the practice of law. The practice of law is, in our professional tradition, statutes matter, especially if they're that precisely articulated. So why do I bring this up? I bring this up because I think your profession, our profession, this profession of paying attention to the detailed legal structure
can give us and even the policymakers we work with a lot of practical leverage in the more or less patents or more or less antitrust debate, so that we are not just engaging in open textured arguments, because open textured arguments basically just boil down to power. Whoever has the best electricity running through their microphone shouts the longest, the loudest, can shout the other person down. That's what open textured debates are all about, raw power. Law, our profession, your secret sauce is the practice of self-restraint and using words and sentences and clauses to restrain. That restrained approach is not against big business. It's just not for big business. It's not against small and medium-sized enterprises. It enables the plurality of small, medium, and large enterprises to be playing in the patent antitrust interface. And so I think one of the basic insights that then can come from all of this is that as we think about the mix of false advertising, trademark, trade remedies, as we think about antitrust and patents, we can craft legal systems that have what lawyers would call technical legal rules. But if we mean what we say and follow those rules, we can navigate a middle of the road course that will end up helping our innovation economy, maintaining a competitive market, and doing it in a way where, unlike the model of large is always better, we are then not putting all of our technological eggs in big baskets only. And that, from a security perspective, means when countries who want to do us harm hack into networks, they have to find a lot more networks and a lot more people rather than the one big basket with all of our secrets in one basket. So let me pause there and welcome a conversation.
Great, thank you, Professor Keefe. So if we could give a round of applause for all of our speakers in their introductory remarks. So let's open this up to a little bit of debate, and I'm going to return to Macon first. And Macon, I guess, generally any response to notes that other speakers have said, and then can you also begin by providing us with an update maybe on what the Federal Trade Commission has recently announced regarding a Section 5 update?
Sure. Well, the first part is easy. It's hard to disagree with anything my colleagues have said here. I think we're all on the same page as far as appreciating the value of intellectual property. And I think each of us, whether in academia or in public service, have tried to explain the importance of that to the future competitiveness of of our country and our economy. And it is amazing, but although I'm not fully shocked that the president did not discuss the benefits of intellectual property. Andre, you're expecting too much. Section 5. So Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, the FTC Act was put in place in 1914, and it's this wonderful law that says, you know, unfair competition practices are illegal. Well, what is that? Nobody really knows. And it's been subject to a lot of debate and litigation. Largely, it's been mostly used in consumer protection cases. In privacy, for example, if you've said you're going to do something, but you do something different than what you've actually said it would, now the FTC has some jurisdiction. And with respect to competition and antitrust, it has largely, over the last 8 years, in 2015, there was a policy statement that was put in place in the Obama administration in a bipartisan fashion. Although, to her credit, Commissioner Olhausen then dissented because she didn't think the policy was clear enough. And I agree with her views on that, is that the FTC didn't go far enough to provide clear guidance to the business community of how they're going to interpret the law. But at least it said they're going to interpret the FTC Act unfair methods of competition coterminous with the court's interpretations of the Sherman Act, meaning that we're not going to ban the law only reaches those unreasonable restraints of trades, not every restraint of trade. Early on in the antitrust world, the Supreme Court said, well, it can't be every contract like the Sherman Act wrote. It must be those that are unreasonable. And then from there, the rule of reason test came about, because if I sign a lease for an apartment, of course, I've now restrained the trade in that because somebody else cannot get into that apartment. And hence the test has come. And the test is, are there pro-competitive effects of a particular business conduct that outweighs the anti-competitive effects that would be? But it's always an effects test. This morning, when the new administration came in, they withdrew that 2015 policy statement without replacing it with any other guidance. They just said, you know what, we know the conduct when we see it, and there's no guidance, but we think that the 2015 statement restricts our views, our ability to enforce the law. This morning, they issued their new Section 5 guidance, which is a doozy. It gets into, they're not going to be limited by the rule of reason. There's not going to be an effects test. They won't care what the actual effect of a particular business conduct is, as long as it tends to restrain competitive conditions. There's no legal understanding of what all of that would mean. It's a very uncertain area with no real guidance to the business community, despite, at one point the Second Circuit had admonished the FTC to provide better guidance in the DuPont case. But here, they have a handful of principles, and they say, we'll know it, whether it affects consumers or workers or others, what it is. And they list a number of them, including abuse of intellectual property rights and abuse of the regulatory process. So, are you going to apply to under your law, under your rights under the law, to extend a particular license or provision in, whether it's the Food and Drug Administration or Department of Agriculture or somewhere else? And does the FTC believe your regulatory filing limits competition? That could be actionable under Section 5. Is your request of an unreasonable royalty rate under your patent law actionable? Yes. Is your licensing practices of who you refuse to license? There was a big fissure between the Justice Department and FTC, and part of the new Madison approach that we had put in place was that if you have a patent, your unconditional and unilateral refusal to license to your competitor shall be per se legal. That cannot be an antitrust violation for you to not give your competitor your patent to exercise. There's a lot of pro-competitive arguments of why you shouldn't do that. And I said there should not be any shade of concern about you refusing to do that. The Federal Trade Commission didn't agree with that view, and that's been kind of actually a bipartisan position of the FTC for some odd reason. And Mr. Abbott is there, and I think he would agree with my point of view in this world, but despite his service at the FTC. But that is an area where it's real concern. And so this is, as of this morning, there's really not a whole lot of guidance yet, but it's it'll be a welcome opportunity for those who want to undo intellectual property rights.
Other comments from the panel? Professor Farley, any?
I find this all very interesting, and it's new to me, this development this morning. As you mentioned, Judge Holt wrote an article about unfair competition law, looking at private unfair competition law, and really looking at the history of U.S. unfair competition law, and noting that unfair competition law in the United States, I think, has developed in fits and starts. And where you started by, well, nobody knows what it is the main takeaway. but we had a moment, which is the moment I wrote about as the lost unfair competition law, where one of the foremost thinkers about unfair competition law the possibilities of private unfair competition law in the United States, who was also quite savvy about global trade and thinking about international treaty development and protections there, had really a very clear idea of how to expand unfair competition law, but unfortunately attempted to do so in quite a tricky way. And it in the end didn't pan out. And so we had then kind of a moment of opportunity for expanded unfair competition protections. And again, I'm talking about kind of companies versus companies, unfair competition protection, which disappeared and we went to nothing. And the development that we've seen since has really been cabined within trademark law, which is a funny version of unfair competition law. So it's done funny things to unfair competition law, and it's also done funny things to trademarks. But I think it is a curiosity about why in 2022 we don't know really what unfair competition law what it is. And I do think there's a danger there. There's a danger in what it could be interpreted to mean, as well as how it doesn't, you know, adequately serve businesses who, you know, should have some protections against deceptive practices by their competitors.
It might very well, accelerate the judicial review of the constitutional makeup of these types of commissions. Federal Trade Commission, they also announced that they're going to do rulemaking, and they're going to tell you what it is. So whatever those rules will be, they're not going to tell you about everything about, you know, your business practice, whether it's anti-competitive or not. But if they don't like it, they'll tell you they can't do it in rules. So earlier this week, as many of you know, the Supreme Court heard both of the cases in the FTC and the SEC case. And we'll see. They didn't get to the merits of that. It's just a procedural step. But I think, you know, I would hope the court on its own will accept the second question that Paul Clement, in his case, tried to seek cert on and hear that case. But if not, if there's this aggressive move by some of these agencies, there might be a fast track to revisit that.
Andre, any comments to other remarks that folks have given?
Well, in general, as I said, as Ms. Macon said, we very much agree on the policy aspects here. To bypass the Section 5 comments and go back to a statement Macon made a minute ago that I would expect too much for the president to mention IP. I guess that's true. But it should not be too much of an expectation for the President of the United States not to give away for free American IP to China and others. I don't think that's too much of an expectation. They literally, this is unprecedented. No administration before this one, Democrat or Republican, has ever agreed to waive intellectual property rights protections for critical technologies that are developed really anywhere in the world, but primarily here in the United States. And by the way, that was limited when they waived IP rights for the vaccine. That was limited to the vaccine. That was 6 months ago. Now they're back at the table discussing whether they should waive IP rights for therapeutics and diagnostics. Instead of the United States saying that's completely off the table, no go, absolutely not. We're not going to engage in such a conversation. Imagine the next pandemic. It takes over $2 billion to bring one of these drugs to market. Imagine who's going to invest in these high-risk, failure-prone technologies and spend $2 billion if they know, if they succeed, and if their products are going to be used widely, they're going to be potentially given away to our competitors. Anyway, so that's just a quick aside. To the point that I'm hearing on this side of the table that in 2022 we don't really know what the unfair competition laws are in the United States, as a patent lawyer, my hair stands up. I mean, it's like, you know, in the back of my head, like, are you kidding me? I don't know how we are supposed to make investments and run our companies and develop our intellectual property rights if we don't know whether they're going to be enforceable, or if I try to enforce them, whether I'm going to be found in violation of some future developed rule on what is and is not an antitrust violation. Here is the reality. For intellectual property rights to be effective, to actually mean something, you first have to obtain them, of course, but then they have to be meaningfully enforceable. If I have intellectual property rights that all they do is they make for nice certificates up on my wall, that doesn't do very much for my business. I need to know that I am able to enforce them if somebody else violates them. And if I cannot make these business decisions well ahead of time, then I don't know what good those rights do to me. So the constant shift in these policy positions are very problematic if you want to have a robust innovation economy.
Scott, comments?
So just a few on the what counts as unfair competition. Again, open textured policy arguments can be great for clicks, they can be great for political campaigns. They're terrible for business decision makers and lawyers who have to argue it's a two-prong test or a three-prong test, and here's the facts in the record that check off prong one, two, and three. And it is just worth noticing that while on the one hand you get these very, very broad debates about, oh, this particular price, it's bad because it's too high, but then this other particular price, actually, you know, it's bad because it's too low. And, you know, somehow one of those is, you know, anti-innovative or anti-competitive because it's charging too much, but the other one is anti-competitive because it's so low, it's chasing everyone out of the market. Those are interesting angels on the head of a pin type of debate. Here's something that is worth noticing while that entire set of debate is playing out, and this is what Professor Farley was getting at, I think, with some of her indications of other areas of law. The United States, Europe, China, every major industrialized country at least says it agrees that bold-faced collusion and market manipulation, those are anti-competitive. Those are market-destroying. And one of the interesting things as lawyers we can do is when we don't know whether the price is too high or too low argument will work, you could engage in those yelling matches or leave those to someone else and instead plead and prove your cases as collusion cases. Because the collusion arguments, those are still available. Similarly, maybe there's some very technical debate or policy debate about which version of unfair competition is available. That's okay. Falsity, plain vanilla falsity, that's still actionable before most US tribunals, most European tribunals, and most Asian tribunals. So you can get, as lawyers practicing the profession, traction for your clients in these anti-competition or market regulation spaces, but go for the collusion arguments, go for the falsity arguments, don't get suckered into these yelling matches.
Well, I'll invite members of the audience to stand at the microphone I see over there if you would like to ask a question. I think it's right in the middle of the room. And then I do have some questions that I've written down myself, but let's go to the audience for the first question. If you could just state your name and your affiliation before asking your question.
Stephen Huff, Arlington, Virginia. Mr. Delahim, you began your remarks talking about innovation in the cell phone industry. Could you share your thoughts on the recent EU regulations, including mandating USB-C charging for all phones?
I think you're referring to in Europe, the European Commission is mandating, you know, many of you in every drawer in your house probably have multiple chargers for your various phones, and every time you upgrade a phone, it's either thinner or thicker. Now you have the USB-C and the micro and the lightning So they are going to be mandating that. There's a give or take. As a consumer, I think I kind of like that. Step back from the policy, I think what it does do is when the government mandates that through the law as opposed to a de facto standard winning is that you limit, you know, competition. You've now seen some of those have, you know, whenever there's been an advancement, it's been better. You know, when you have the lightning connection as opposed to the previous one, not only was it smaller, but it was waterproof. The charging is faster. So the question becomes, will the government's regulation inhibit innovation that would take place? The trade-off is that, you know, you're going to have one charger that'll fit all your devices and, you know, it won't move. It's just that heavy-handed government industrial policy, I think, you know, it's one. If the government can update those fast enough to catch up with technology, but then now it's you're leaving it to a handful of bureaucrats to decide that rather than the marketplace deciding that. So it's, you know, it's on one hand, I could see the short-term value, but I think long-term, it's the wrong policy.
Ben Slifka, I'm a retired monopolist. Microsoft, I was at Microsoft 14 years. Internet Explorer is my fault. So if we had done a shitty job, the DOJ would have had to find some other pretense to sue Microsoft for antitrust. Anyway, my question is, given the dynamics of China and its IP regimen there, what you know, if a president or Congress wanted to really do something to level the playing field with China, what would we do?
Scott, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that ideas behind the policies matter a lot, and one of the core ideas of our ecosystem, our legal systems. Remember, these are systems. These are like our antitrust system is not one statute. Our patent system is not one statute. There are a bunch of components to what I'm about to say. But I think if you take a set of legal tools that on average do not attempt to pick winners and losers, they don't try to be pro-big business or anti-big business or pro-small business or anti-small business, that if you write the rules in a way that are directly functionally related to the economic problems you're trying to solve. So in the innovation space, I think that's a coordination problem. So not patents are carrots for inventors to invent, but patents are beacons around which inventors, venture capitalists, manufacturers can coordinate with each other. That if you start to build those legal rules, and we have them already in our system, if the executive branch and the legislative branch stick to those rules, that's your answer. That's the answer to your question. It's not picking chips and funding those. It's not picking drugs and funding those. It's not defunding people with Chinese-sounding names. It's this more legally, technically oriented strategy that's going to work.
Other comments on that?
Yeah, so two prongs. Number one, China has to, number one, we have to insist in our trade agreements and then enforce them that China must stop taking our stuff, to put it simply, okay? So forced technology transfers that still take place in China, that must stop, as an example. The transparency of the ability to enforce your rights in the Chinese market against infringers, that must stop. The unbridled counterfeiting, 80% of the world's counterfeiting comes from China and its territories. That's got to stop. We have to insist that China stop its theft of intellectual property, number one. Number two, we need to make sure that here in the United States, we don't facilitate the giveaway of our IP to China and others. So that is, again, through trade agreements, as well as the robust enforcement of our intellectual property laws, not picking winners and losers, just enforce the laws that we have here in the United States. And number three, we have to compete. We will never compete in the number of people we have in this country. We can't, obviously. And we don't have a centralized economy. There, they have decided that they're going to focus their economic power on 5, 6, 7 technologies. They've told us what they are in their Made in China 2025, 2030 plans and so on. We can't do that here. But we have to enable our population to innovate more, and more people in our in the United States have to get involved in the innovation economy. And as a nation, we need to innovate multiple times at the rate that we are doing right now. And we have that capacity. We just have to unleash it. So this is a three-prong approach, in my view.
Any other comments?
No? May I just very briefly say, just in the spirit of fostering debate, I worry that calling what China's doing IP theft tricks us too much. If we give it to them, it's not theft. It's we made a mistake giving it to them. And so I think we have to be more straightforward with ourselves about that's they're telling us how they're running their economy. They're telling us they do military-civil fusion or civil-military fusion. They're telling us they see us as their enemy. I think it's okay to believe them. And so, you know, when people are that demonstrative with their highly coordinated, highly organized adversity, I take them seriously, take them at their word. And that means I wouldn't strike deals with them because there's no reason to think they're going to stick to their deals. I mean, do the deals if you think they're helpful because of the cash value on the dash when you sign the deal, but I wouldn't expect anything more out of the deal tomorrow because they've shown us that's not how they play ball. So I take them at their word. I think that coordinating our internal structure, that's where we get our biggest dividend. I'm afraid that these other efforts are high cost and low yield. They're not dumb. They're definitely well motivated, and this is a highly talented individual offering them. So this is, I am offering merely a contrasting idea in the spirit of conversation.
I don't disagree with any of that, but we have to play with all the cards that we're given. So to the extent we can utilize our diplomatic powers to stop their bad activities, I don't think we should ignore that. I think we should try to do that. At the same time, it's an all of the above approach. At the same time, there's no question we have, that was my second prong, don't give it away. Know what they're doing and monitor our own activities to make sure that we don't enable them to do that. No question about that.
Next question.
Bill Wichterman at Covington. First of all, you're all rock stars. Thanks for all your important work in this area. So my question is about the conservative movement, both in the policy-making space and in the judicial realm, often policy-making, that it seems like it's adrift in both competition and innovation. I understand why the left would be putting out guidance like they did today from the FTC, or why they'd want, perhaps some would want, weaker patents or something views based on their views of property and markets. I don't understand it well on the right, and there are strong strains within the conservative movement that either don't get the importance of intellectual property or don't get, out of their fury perhaps at the platform companies over content moderation, don't get the importance of a light touch when it comes to competition policy. And we've seen this also at the Supreme Court. Love to hear your thoughts, not your hopes nor your fears, but your predictions as to where the conservative movement might be going on all of this.
Andre, do you want to go first and maybe mention your new group that you've started recently?
Well, it's a really excellent question, Bill. And I don't know what the source of it is, but conservatives who are pro-property rights in general should certainly be in favor of strong intellectual property rights. There is a reason why the founders put intellectual property rights in the Constitution itself, right? The only time the word right is mentioned is in the Constitution is with respect to intellectual property rights in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8. And they saw the need to lay it out for all of us to see that this must be protected. If you think about the Lockean view, which usually, you know, philosophical conservatives agree with, that the property, the piece of land, for example, belongs to that, to the individual who works it and puts his or her own sweat into it and develops it, then you have the rights to that property and to protect it. Even more so, it's true for intellectual property rights. An idea, a thought, an invention, a song, a painting did not exist in the world at all until the creator created it, whereas the land did exist and you improved it, which is great. But these intellectual ideas and creations are made by the human being, him or herself, and would not exist and would not be put out to the public unless it is, unless the individual wants to put it out. So an intellectual property right is to tell the government telling the individual, if you give it to the public, it's in your head, if you give it to the public, we'll protect you. Now it's out, I've done my part, I've given it to the public, now you, the public, need to protect me. That seems to me an inherently conservative idea, and that should be protected. Let me make one constitutional point as well. It's an interesting point that, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, it says that we have certain inalienable rights, and governments are established to secure those inalienable rights. Okay, governments are not established to give those rights, they're established to secure those rights. So when the word secured is used, it's meant to protect that's already there, that you already have. The same language is in the Constitution with respect to intellectual property rights. If you look at Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, it gives Congress the power to secure the rights, the exclusive rights, to secure the exclusive rights to inventors and authors to their respective inventions and writings. It's not to give them the rights, it's to secure them the rights that they already have. That's what these property rights are about. And, you know, once you have them, they have to be protected because that's the quid pro quo that the rule of law demands. So it seems to me that it should be something that conservative jurists should be on top of. It's not, you're right, Bill, I don't think they're all there, and I'm not sure why.
Any notes on C4IP and what your group will do?
C4IP, the Council for Innovation Promotion, it's actually a bipartisan group that its goal is to educate the public and members of Congress about the inextricable connection between IP and innovation, the stuff that we've been talking about today. You cannot have innovation without strong and robust intellectual property protections. And we are there to educate the public about those facts and to support members and promote members who actually do that. And we just launched last month.
Just to ground some of this in the kind of the language of the left and the right and the technocrat, in the language of those who care about the little people, the people disenfranchised and out of the game, let's remember intellectual property rights are all about enabling people to acquire and build capital around their own ideas, not just the happenstance that they were born rich or born entitled to a lot of land, that they can do capital formation around their fashion ideas, their inventive ideas, their creative ideas, their trendy ideas. So if you like looking at the people who are subordinated or disenfranchised and trying to give them a leg up, IP does that. If you want to think about this through the, let's call it, the language of property, as was just discussed, we also should notice, of course, that property rights are quite functional in our modern society, even if they are intangible. Sure, you can get occasionally a 2008-type crash around intangible assets like mortgages and mortgage-backed securities. I am not making the claim that these are always good all the time, everywhere, forever. But I am making the claim that even at the bottom of the 2008 crash, our economy was doing shockingly well. And we picked ourselves right back up and got running down that road right afterwards because of lots of intangible assets like IP. And then if you're a technocrat in the middle between the kind of market-oriented thinking or the uplifting thinking, and you want to think about the language of market regulation and property, I think one of the problems that you've identified is that a lot of those cases get argued in hyper-technical arguments, and people get themselves pretzeled. So, for example, in the cases this week that the Supreme Court has, one it denied cert, one it granted cert, but these are patent cases around the disclosure requirements of patent law. These are hyper-technical arguments that basically go like this. You may own this room. You may have defined the boundary of the room. But if trespasser Susan Smith walks in and her name wasn't on your keep out list, well, then you can't keep her out because you haven't defined your property. And by the way, not only can you not keep her out because you haven't defined your property, you didn't define your property, so you no longer own the room. And that's a cute trick. And that's the trick that's happening in these disclosure debates around patents. But I think the lawyers have to be careful to reframe their debates in ordinary property language, ordinary market definition language, and they can hold on to some of those arguments. But they've been losing those arguments. I think they get themselves twisted up into knots. It shouldn't matter that her name's not in the deed, because the deed is about this, not about her, the trespasser.
Next question.
Hi, Ashok Pinto, thanks a lot for a very engaging discussion. I wonder if we could talk for a moment about patent quality. Congress identified a problem with patent quality and addressed it through the America Invents Act, through inter partes review, which was meant to create an expert judicial review within the Patent Trial and Appeal Board to weed out patents that shouldn't have been issued in the first place. So, certainly there's been a lot of great discussion about strong IP protections and the importance of fostering an innovation economy. But I wondered if the panel could comment on that, which is, you know, with I think on average a patent examiner spends less than 20 hours examining a patent. So there's clearly a quality issue that Congress identified and created a remedy for. So I just wondered if you could comment on that in light of promoting a strong IP system, which I think everyone can agree on. Thank you.
Former director.
I didn't quite get the whole thing, but I heard patent quality and PTAB and Congress and all that. So, the question is there a patent quality problem? Well, look, patents are imperfect instruments. You're trying to represent with words complicated technical ideas and do comparisons, you know, to the what's called the prior art. Are you the first inventor and you're comparing, you know, your new technology to the old technology, and you're doing that by comparing words to words. So there's more of an art than a science sometimes, and there's always going to be, there's going to be a certain level of error in judgment, especially one because you do the comparison in the first instance in the patent office during examination with limited time and resources by the examiners, and then it's later tested in litigation years down the line with a lot more resources. So there's always going to be that gap, and it's not just with patents, it's true with trademarks, it's true with copyrights, and it's true all over the world. It's always going to be there. You want to minimize those deficiencies for sure and improve as much as you can the accuracy of what you have come up with. Now, the question though on the table is the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, which was created by Congress and signed by President Obama into law in 2012, is that the right mechanism to make those corrections? The fact of the matter is that we already have a mechanism. It's been around from the beginning of the country, and that's called the Article III Courts. You can always correct for errors in patenting during litigation in an independent Article III courts. You don't necessarily need to go back to the same issuing agency to do that. Now, Congress said that you can, and that's fine. My view was, though, that if you're going to have an alternative process for checking for errors, alternative to the district courts, it needs to be a true alternative, and that the one thing we should not do is duplicate the error correction process. In other words, we shouldn't review the same patent for the same error multiple times, over and over again, in multiple forums. If you're gonna do an error correction check, do it once, do it right, and don't do it again.
So I think that might be our last question, but just one follow-up to Professor Farley on that question. Beyond patents, other areas of intellectual property are sometimes referred to as a poor man's IP. Is that a useful way to think about the broader landscape of IP rights?
It sounds degrading, but I think it is useful. I mean, I think that at certain points, for small companies, startups, the patent system seems very intimidating and very costly. And there are other routes to start to receive the protection. And just to refer to what Scott said about the beacons that they offer, right? The signaling process that a company has by having a trademark, by having a registered design, or something else can help them to get much needed investments. So I do think thinking about the broader landscape and how it all works together is really useful.
Excellent. Well, that is all we have time for, but I just want to thank all of the panelists who are all wonderful friends of mine for taking the time out. Thank the audience for the excellent questions, and sorry we did not have time for all the questions. And let's give the panelists a final round of applause.